Let me begin by thanking the organizers for the National Science Foundation for the funding, to Matthew for such a good introduction, and to the collaborators on this, Craig Maloney, who's here. We started working on this back in another workshop long ago, although he's been working in the area longer as well. Mike Salerno, who was did this for his thesis, and Joel Klemmer, who sent me the most recent things 2 hours ago just to make my life interesting. So I want to talk about these complex events of the kind you see here, and like all of us and like this whole meeting, what's the motivation? It's that there are these power laws indicating potentially critical behavior in a wide range of different systems. And the specific thing which intrigued me was that in almost all of the examples that people have looked at, they've assumed overdamped dynamics. That is, that inertia was completely irrelevant. And when people have looked at the effect of inertia, there's been the impression that that destroys criticality, as in sand piles and some other cases I'll discuss later on. And yet we know that the Earth, in this little picture of an earthquake, has wonderful power laws. It's hard to see that it's necessarily overdamped. Laboratory samples being compressed also shouldn't necessarily be overdamped. So is inertia really a killer for critical phenomena? And I'm going to show you the answer is no. I also want to then show you some results related to the things Matthew was talking about, and talk a little bit about some very complicated spatiotemporal correlations between avalanches that may make the situation more complicated than he described. So the system we're looking at is extremely simple. It's been studied by a number of other people, including people in this room. It's basically a binary Lennard-Jones system with big and little spheres that suppress crystallization, so we have a nice, robust, amorphous state. The characteristic energy won't be too important, but that's mu. The particle diameter is our unit of length, and we'll have a Lennard-Jones time. We take these, we create a liquid, we quench them rapidly. It doesn't much matter how we get to an initial state at zero temperature and pressure, because that memory of that state is erased rather quickly. We shear with periodic boundary conditions, pure shear, squeezing in this direction, expanding in the other. We've done other kinds of simple shear, and we see exactly the same results. Some of the time, I'll show you results at constant strain rate, and other times we'll stop to make sure that an avalanche has fully completed before we count it as an event. And the thing that's going to be our knob to control at the beginning is the amount of damping, which affects the degree of inertia. You can imagine that there's damping on the absolute velocity, which would be appropriate, say, for a foam raft on a liquid substrate, or maybe the Earth on the mantle. Or something that's Galilean invariant, where you're only damping velocity difference. And we've done this with both thermostats, and all the exponents are the same, so I'm mainly going to show you the Langevin case. So what does one see? As in several previous talks, there's a elastic loading and then sudden drops in the stress or energy, which indicate an avalanche. This is the region that's dependent upon the initial state. We're going to be looking at the statistics in steady state. This can be difficult to see in experiments, but it's a very well-defined state. The initial approach to that is very dependent upon exactly how one makes the initial state. And just from this very simple first transparency, you can see inertia makes a difference because the mean energy of the systems is very different as we go from high damping, low inertia, to low damping. There's no overlap between the energies sampled by these different systems during the shear. So they're sampling totally different states. And the reason is that inertia is allowing you basically not to get stuck in the lowest metastable minimum, but to carry on beyond that and find lower energy states. You can also see immediately by eye that the statistics of avalanches in these cases are different. There's more big events in this case than in this case. So these are some of the clear differences that just that plot lets one see. So I'm going to characterize avalanches, and at the beginning I'm going to be doing a simulation where whenever we see something start to happen, we stop straining the system and we let the system completely evolve until the dynamic stops. So we have gathered together all the drop and all the energy change associated with a causal event. Once something went unstable, we wait until we find a true metastable new state. And we're going to characterize the size by the energy drop and then an extensive stress drop. This is chosen so this would correspond to the energy associated with a stress drop of this magnitude, assuming an average stress in the system with this magnitude and a shear modulus given by mu. Okay? And defined in this way, then we have a sum rule, again, that Matthew mentioned, which that is that the sum of the stress drops and the integral over all stress drops, the integral over all energy drops, has to be exactly equal. This is something that Itamar also has discussed. And in one of the important things that's distinct from what I'm going to do in many approaches is I'm going to talk about a rate of events of a given size. And I'm going to do that per unit energy and per unit strain. And many times people look at normalized distributions, but that doesn't address this issue Matthew talked about of the fact that small events are less likely in large systems. So here's a plot showing typical results for the stress drop. You can see this looks like a usual sort of critical behavior. There's some small events, there's a power law. The power law gets cut off, and it gets cut off at higher values as you go to bigger system sizes. These are the linear dimensions, so these are going up to a couple of million atoms and on down. You see similar behavior for the overdamped and the underdamped, except that the form of the cutoff in the underdamped is a little different. There's this little plateau and a drop. But I want to convince you that this is just an unusual finite size scaling cutoff and not something that's not critical. Now, as I said, this is not normalized, and I've divided by L to the gamma. And if, as discussed earlier, we had the probability of a given site being equally likely to have a small event in a large system as in a small system, then I should have to normalize by L to the D to make these collapse. And in fact, I have to normalize by L to the gamma, where gamma is substantially less than the dimension, which is 2 in this case. So there's a striking deviation from that extensive behavior. So we can do a finite size scaling relations. And again, these are closely related, unfortunately, with different notation from what Matthew discussed this morning. But the basic idea is that there's a total amount of work that you're going to do during a unit strain, which is just going to be the stress times the size of the system. And that total work you're going to do is just going to be an integral over all of the events. And given this finite size scaling onsets, where L to the alpha would be the way the largest event scales, and this he called the fractal dimension, and I'll discuss why that's not my favorite choice a little later on. Then if we just plug this into here, we find that we have to have beta plus 2 alpha equal to D. So that's one relation. And then if we say that we expect that at small events, we should have the event sizes scaling like the size to the minus tau, then one can see that this gamma, the number of events of a small size, should scale with a power beta plus alpha tau. And it's interesting that if we were in a case where we had gamma equal to the dimension of space, the only way we could resolve that is with tau equals 2, which is very far from mean field and everything else. So there is this strong suppression. So we can now use this to do finite size scaling collapses of the data. So here are the rates for the energy and the stress in the overdamped and underdamped case. And in both you are able to find a nice finite size scaling collapse of the data with the indicated values of these exponents. And you can see that you get the S was chosen so that S corresponds roughly to E, and you see that you see critical scaling over the same range of S and E roughly in both systems. There's different behavior for small events, and in fact, it's a very annoying large power law in this regime that wasted a lot of our time, which turned out to be a red herring and not critical behavior at all. But unfortunately, for many of our initial simulations and earlier work with systems that are 100 and smaller, most of the events are really down in this regime, and it's hard to detect this power law tau until you get to very large system sizes. The overdamped, the key point here is that this plateau is collapsing. It has the same shape independent of system size. It's just moving to larger events. And there's a number of other critical systems which show scaling functions with a tail like this, particularly where there's some conserved quantity that has to add up. So when you cut off large events, the weight has to be pushed in. So this is not typical, but it's entirely consistent with critical scaling. So we have these two limiting cases, and an interesting question is how do we go from one to the other? So if we think about the exponent describing the largest event, which is going like L to the alpha, then we can define a characteristic maximum event, which would be given by the mean of E squared over the mean of E. I don't want to work strictly with the mean of E because it turns out there's lots and lots of small events. So when you define the mean events, the lots and lots of tiny events screws up the average. You're dividing by infinity in some cases. So you have to work with a moment like this that's well defined. But if I do E cubed over E squared or anything else, I get the same result. And what you see then is that when gamma is large, going from 10 down to about 0.1, if you assume that the exponent is alpha, you find that the largest event collapses for all these different system sizes. So this whole regime seems to be described by the overdamped critical exponent. It's just that there's some characteristic length that's increasing as we approach what is maybe, I'm going to argue, a multi-critical point. If we go from the other side, where we're in the underdamped limit, again, we get a collapse with this other exponent, alpha. So it seems there's two types of critical behavior separated by something like a multi-critical point, and it has its own scaling with its own exponents, interestingly, with more orders of magnitude of scaling than any of the other cases, and an exponent around 1. So this is an unusual system with equal energy, basically, in all decades. So that's looking, that certainly seems consistent with there just being a different universality class in the underdamped limit. And to really make sure that we don't have something like the hysteresis that you find, say, in sand, you know with sand that there's an angle you need to initiate motion and there's a different angle to stop. And that hysteresis is supposed to persist for large sizes and be related to the inertia of the sand grains. So if that kind of thing was going on, then if I were to say, look at the distribution of the peak values before an avalanche and the distribution of the trough values after an avalanche, those would be two separate peaks. But this is showing the distribution of the peaks and the troughs, and you can see that for all these different system sizes, the open and closed systems basically overlap. There's no gap opening up in the distribution at all. And in fact, as you go to larger system sizes, both distributions narrow down, as you might expect if this is a normal critical point. So we can, did I forget something? No, I guess not. So we can actually then look to see how the width varies. And if the RMS width were to vary like L to the minus phi, one guess for what phi should be is just given, assuming the size of the variations in stress are comparable to the size of the largest events. The largest events are order L to the alpha, so the largest, the change associated with that would go like L, 1 over L to the d minus alpha, so we would have phi given by that. In fact, we find that only in some cases, and the reason is that we don't have quench disorder. If we had a system that was fixed for all time, that would be one thing, but we have a system where the disorder keeps getting regenerated every time we shear it. And so you're going to get fluctuations in the strength of shearing from one moment to the next. And so you can get fluctuations of order 1 over square root of n, or 1 over L to the d over 2. And for all the systems we've looked at, we find that the value of phi is the minimum of these values, because that's the one that decays most slowly and therefore dominates in large system sizes. And in fact, it turns out for the overdamped case, it's always d over 2, not d minus alpha. And this was the scenario that Mathieu had assumed, but it's not what we find in this particular case, because we have a different alpha than he had. Okay, so if we had this dominating, then this would correspond to the correlation length exponent, but where we get d over 2, it doesn't. So we have to be careful about associating phi with the correlation length. So these are values that we find for a range of dimensionality. So these are different gammas from overdamped to underdamped in 2 and 3 dimensions. And here you see that phi is d over 2 for the overdamped case. This particular system, people have not looked at most of these exponents before. There is work that in general showed alpha was 1 or less, as opposed to bigger than 1, as in the lattice model that Mathieu had talked about. And there was a value for a 3D amorphous system. All of these are on relatively small systems, and which may, I think, explain the deviations from what we saw. If we look at the mean field models for depinning, you can see that they predict 1.5, and tau is never as big as 1.5 in any of these cases. It's that's clearly too big. That's right, and I've just added this one. So I mentioned that calling alpha the fractal dimension is complicated. Clearly, the largest event scales like L to the alpha. But the question is the largest event a fractal? So this is a typical largest event in an overdamped and underdamped case. This thing doesn't span space. It's spanned the system. It's clearly got a dimension less than 1. But normally, what you would do is you would take the Fourier transform, and the power law decay of the transform would tell you about the fractal dimension. In this case, the power law decay of this event is not simple. So if we look at a direction of 45 degrees, pi over 4, you see much more correlation than on other directions. And in fact, we find not just different prefactors, but different power laws in those different directions. So how that correlates to a simple fractal with a fractal dimension is not so clear to me. Okay, so as I mentioned, the lattice models, many of them suggest that we should see mean field exponents. We do not see that. And as Mathieu has discussed, all of these models have a positive definite elastic coupling. They obey the no passing rule. And the quadrupolar field induced by shear violates those rules. We have positive and negative forces now. And as he argued, this leads to sort of random fluctuations, and the key point being that the distribution of distances needed to reach an instability goes to zero, that there's an exponent theta which is bigger than zero, and there's very few nearly unstable states. And that can explain why there's subextensive scaling, why gamma is less than D, why there's fewer small avalanches. And it gives qualitatively similar behavior to what we see with slightly different exponents. So alpha is bigger than 1 in their case and smaller than ours, and it's different in 3D. Slightly different values of tau, but not huge discrepancies. And Damien, I'd guess, found an exponent that was close to 5/4, which is also close to R. So these models all seem to be qualitatively similar and different from the mean field theory in an important way, but not necessarily with exactly the same exponents. So what's new that I haven't talked about before is the dynamic exponents, this exponent relating the strain rate to the stress that Mathieu introduced, and which he found was something in this range in 2D, and I'm going to show you we find has got a higher value in our simulations. So this is the mean shear stress versus strain rate for a particular size, and it's got the results for over-critically and under-damped. And what's interesting is in the under-damped limit, you actually get a drop in the stress with rising strain rate. And that seems to be because you're shearing the system fast enough that the energy going in can't get sucked out by the thermostat fast enough. And so it's effectively heating up, and there's a pseudo-temperature that's in allowing activation over metastable barriers and letting you get motion at a lower strain rate as you go faster. The critical damping rate, it's interesting, this value that seemed to be a multi-critical point, has the special property that the stress does not depend upon strain rate. And if you look at the actual evolution, it seems that this is the one where the damping is just right so that as an avalanche is developing, you're sucking out the energy that's being released by the deformation as fast as it's putting in. So you're just, it's just like critically damping your screen door. You're really taking the energy out just at the right rate. And if we use a different damping, we have totally different damping mechanisms, but it's the same property if we have a Galilean or Langevin damping. Okay, so these I'm not going to talk about the dynamic scaling. I'm going to focus on this, which is more related to the other models that have been discussed here. And it turns out that there's sort of new physics that can enter in this system when we go faster. And this is related to the fact that stress takes time to propagate in our system. Normally, people using lattice models use the Green's function for the static case, assuming instantaneous transfer of information about displacements through the whole sample. That doesn't happen here, and there's some extra dynamics that is important at high rates and changes the physics. So I'll be doing the scaling at low rates where we don't see that being important. So here is the stress versus strain rate for different system sizes. And again, you see smaller systems deviate sooner, that is at higher strain rates from the curve. And we can do basically the same finite size scaling argument that Mathieu had discussed earlier, saying that there's a characteristic scaling of stress fluctuations. And before I had L to the phi for this, and I've got a different phi prime here for reasons that will become clear in a minute. But if we have a scaling like this, then at large rates we expect the argument, this to go like the argument to the beta. So that requires that this prefactor have that exponent. And at small rates, we would expect just to have a constant, that the rate wouldn't matter. Now, the key thing is that the deviation of the constant from the critical point is determined by a different exponent, because now at constant rate, we sample over all possible random realizations. So the D over 2, the random fluctuations, don't enter. That was what controlled phi in our system, but this phi prime is always equal to D minus alpha. That fluctuation between ensembles is gone. So we see this is equal to D minus alpha as opposed to D over 2. And that's sort of, it's nice that one can separate those two effects in this system. This is actually testing that finite size scaling collapse for systems up to now 1600 squared, and you get a pretty good collapse with this value of given by our previous determination of alpha, and beta equals 1.78. And this is just showing you plotting that another way where you, there's less cheating. You get the same exponent. So there's another thing which we can look at, which may be surprising to you, and that's the diffusion constant. We find that the diffusion coefficient can be defined based on the fluctuations about the affine displacement, which grow linearly with the strain interval that we look at. And the prefactor of this we can define as a diffusion constant. And I'm sorry, this should be 4 in 2 dimensions, but don't worry about that. And so this diffusion constant, it turns out, shows also dependence upon strain rate. It starts at large values and drops with increasing strain rate. And in fact, the value at low strain rates rises linearly with L. That's sort of a bizarre thing that you would have a diffusion constant that was system size dependent, but it's something that Craig and I rationalized based on the long-range spatial correlations that you see in this system. And if we assume that it goes like L, we can do a scaling, so D times 1 over L, and use the same sort of scaling as before to collapse the strain rate, and we get a good collapse, but the value of beta phi that we get is yet another value than what we saw before. Okay, so this is what we got for the stress, and for the diffusion, we get something different. And again, I think this is related to the fact that there's this different scaling of the correlation functions and the system size in different directions. It turns out that there's long time interval correlations in where damage occurs. And what this shows is the result of a single avalanche in the underdamped case, and a whole succession of avalanches starting from the same initial condition in the overdamped case. And what I want you to see is where damage will occur is predetermined by the initial conditions. It's going to get there through many more avalanches in this case than in this case, but the pattern has some large-scale structure that's very robust. And if we look at the net deformation that's produced after a given strain interval for different values of the damping, overdamped, critical, and underdamped, these are different measures. This is measuring the divergence of the density. This is the curl, and this is the J2 invariant for the stress. You see, independent of the damping, you get the same spatial correlations. So there's really something going on here that's much bigger than avalanches. Avalanches tend to cluster and keep on forming to make large structures that span the system in the limit of quasi-static motion. When we begin to go faster, we start to break up that structure. So instead of seeing space little diagonals that span the system, they are finite in extent. And so you see that the small q, large length scale behavior, begins to be depressed because of this decorrelation. And you get less and less as you go to higher strain rate. Once again, we can do a finite size scaling collapse, assuming the same sort of finite size scaling ansatzes as before. And this shows results for the correlations along 0 and 45 degrees. It's the same along 90 and minus 45. And once again, we find that this ratio beta over nu is different in these two, different directions. So just to put up my conclusions, I hope that I've convinced you that we have some different universality behavior in the overdamped and underdamped limits, that inertia does not kill the critical behavior, and that a lot of what we've seen is described quite well by some of the ideas Matthew talked about earlier today. But this strange anisotropic scaling in these systems with different power laws in different directions, not at 90 degrees to each other, but at 45 degrees to each other, I think is a challenge that still needs to be sorted out.
Yeah, thanks, Mark, for the nice talk. Are there questions?
Mark, very nice presentation. I have two quick questions. First one is that in your model, you predict this slope of 1.25. In Professor Damon and her colleagues, they predict 1.5 by based on mean field theory. What could be the reason for this difference? That's the first question. The second question is that in your model, can you predict the temperature effect?
Okay, so I think that my personal feeling is that the explanation that you discussed this morning, where instead of having a constant density of different distances from instability, one has some other power law with no states really right at instability, explains the difference between the two cases. And in terms of the temperature, I think we've looked a little bit at that. It gets very difficult to identify events when you start having temperature. And I didn't talk about the avalanche statistics tau at finite rate, just because at finite rate they all start jumbling together and it gets very difficult to tell them apart. In theory, one can try to look at Fourier transforms, but it turns out that the dynamics of stress transformation in this case make that more complicated than in the mean field models.
Thank you. Sorry, hi Mark. This may be irrelevant, but if you were to look at some of this from a continuum mechanics perspective, if you think this is a rather soft and you had bands of deformation at 45 degrees, it seemed, I mean, you would expect correlation lengths to be longer and at 45 degrees than in any other direction, because you have much less stiffness in that direction. Equations are nearly hyperbolic. You sort of almost have characteristics underlying the field at 45 degrees, and so I don't know if that has any relation to the different exponents you're seeing, but.
Well, yeah, so this is the specific angle that relieves stress most efficiently, and so clearly that's why it's different in all these models, and so that part's not surprising. If it was merely a different correlation length with the same scaling exponent and a different prefactor, that would be more usual. Right. It's unusual to have a different exponent. But I think that in all these models, it's clear that that angle is chosen because it's the most efficient one. And I should say you can change the aspect ratios of the box and do other things. Yeah. It has nothing to do with using a square box, right?
Right. I mean, I think it's it's underlying in the material behavior there.
Yeah.
You raise an interesting question. It's not unprecedented to have two different exponents in two different directions, but but it's usually at right angles so that you can have different rescalings in the different directions.
Yes.
Are you suggesting that ordinary critical phenomena where there's only one diverging length scale, or, you know, there's, can you define a rescaling if you look at things a factor of b apart in one direction and b to the x in the other direction? It sounds like that's doomed here.
As far as I've been able to figure out, yes. It's highly unusual.
So this is a case where mean field theory is going to be not described by a renormalization group kind of picture, you think?
I don't understand how to do it yet. I think it would be interesting to have ideas. But as I've shown you, I mean, we just seem to be seeing that there's different exponents and not a single light. So.
There's a sense in which we talk in our paper too about having two length scale if indeed nu is smaller than two over d, just like charge density wave, right? Just like what happens for charge density wave.
Right. So there's, there it is. So there's different, one could talk about different exponents that are related to this difference. And that would be, but I guess what I've shown is by doing the averaging, I get rid of this effect and I just pick up that. So I can separately measure this and this, but then when I look at these other measures, the correlation lengths and the diffusion length, I seem to be getting a different exponent than either of these two. So this is something that I get rid of by averaging over long times. I pick up this, which is related to the size of the largest avalanche compared to the system and not necessarily really a single length. This still involves the size of the avalanche. But the other things which really try to measure a length directly by looking at S of Q and looking at the diffusion, I seem to see two different exponents. It would be simpler if I didn't.
No questions? And let me also ask one. If you increase the strain rate, can you get to some other effective description?
If I go fast enough, I guess this is probably not a bad. So even at strain rates of 10 to minus 3, you're looking at a correlation length that's only a few, like 10 atoms. And if you keep on going rapidly, there's just sort of no correlations at all. Of course, these would be, if you were thinking about an amorphous metal, these would be rather huge strain rates, 10 to the ninth or something like that in seconds units. So I don't think that's very practical. The other thing which I mentioned in these high velocity regimes, you get, this is something Jean-Louis and others have looked at, when you take a system and you apply an affine deformation, there are large non-affine displacements, particularly on scales less than 30 or so atomic spacings. And those can be very slow. And so if you start straining the system rapidly, you don't allow those. And so in this regime, if you just were to measure the linear elastic constant, you would begin to find fairly large rate dependence just in the linear elasticity, which has nothing to do with the kind of thing we're interested in and is just related to that stress dynamics relaxation. Some people might say it's related to the frequencies of the boson peak or something else would be another way of thinking about that that regime.
Okay.
Okay. quick question. Have you tried open boundary conditions at the side? Right now you have periodic in all directions, right? If you change the boundary conditions to see what you get?
Well, the problem with having like an open boundary condition on the side is, you know, then you're just as bad as the experimentalist. No, it is. It's a problem. It's hard to reach steady state in that limit because what happens is you sort of push the edge, push things off, and you shear the system off just because the cross section has changing. What you'd like to do is something in experiments, more like a Coetzee or something that also could avoid doing that. We have done two plates confining a system in Couette flow, so we've looked at simple shear as opposed to pure shear, where we have like confining solid walls but periodic boundaries in one direction, and we see the same type of scaling in those simulations as we do with two periodic boundaries. But I...
Yeah.
What?
Again, right?
We've done fixed volume, we've done fixed stress. We find in the steady state that it goes to some asymptotic value. We start with pressure equal zero, but we fix the area. And the reason we haven't done pressure-controlled ensembles is the equations of motion in an MD simulation for pressure control introduce a whole new set of dynamics that can interfere with the avalanche statistics. So it's better to avoid.
Okay, no more questions, then let's move on. Head of schedule.